Raised in a small Pennsylvania town outside of Philadelphia, musician John Oates was exposed to folk, blues, soul, and R&B. Meeting and teaming up with Daryl Hall in the late 1960s, they developed a style of music that was uniquely their own, but never abandoned their roots. Daryl Hall and John Oates have over 20 albums together, more than 60 million records sold, and 29 top 40 hits. They're the most successful pop duo in the world and members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Relying on his handwritten journals, John Oates brings to light many fascinating stories spanning his entire life with his new memoir, Change of Seasons. And it is a great pleasure to welcome John Oates to the roundtable this morning. John, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you with us. At what point did you say, all right, I think now would be the time for me to write my memoir?
Well, I had done a series of interviews with a fellow named Chris Epting over the years, and Chris seemed to get me, and he was a big fan of my solo work. And during the course of various conversations, he said, you've had such an interesting life, and have you ever, you know, thought about writing a book? And I said, well, I've considered it, but never got around to it. He said, well, you should do it, and I'd like to help you. And that's how it started. I had done a series of handwritten journals from the entire decade of the 70s, from the time I graduated college, because I knew that whatever I was going to do after graduating college was going to be something significant. I didn't know what it was. I hadn't even, you know, I wasn't working with Daryl at the time or anything like that. So I made a copies of these 13 volumes of handwritten journals and sent them to Chris. Chris laid them out in a timeline and began to dig through them, and he started teeing me up with things that had happened and experiences and stuff that he thought was noteworthy, and I began to write. And he's a great researcher and a really great editor, and he really helped me through the process.
Give us a sense of, and you certainly read about this in the book, but music always a part of your life. At what point you started to think about it as, okay, this is what I want to do with my life?
I never didn't think about it. It never even was a consideration. It wasn't something that I consciously thought about. Like when I was a little kid, I didn't say, I'm going to be a musician for the rest of my life. I just was a musician. I was naturally, had a natural gift for music and an aptitude for it. And I would just did it. And every time I did it, people seemed to like it. It was almost one of those things where I think back, if there would have been a moment or a time or a period of time where I was playing music and people were going like, hey man, you should consider another career choice might be a good alternative. Maybe I would have, done it. But people always seemed to like what I did, regardless of what configuration it was, whether I was playing folk songs in a coffee house or playing with my high school band and then on and on and on. And that's how I always approached my life. It wasn't a conscious decision. It was almost as if I was compelled to it.
You grew up in North Wales, Pennsylvania, a town that I lived right next door to growing up. And in fact, your boyhood home was not far from where my just a couple houses down from where my violin teacher lived. So you certainly were well known when I was growing up as maybe a decade and a half behind you. But when you look at that town and living in the suburbs of Philadelphia, of what that access that gave you to music, and ultimately you talked about your high school band a moment ago, of able to create that to set you in the right direction.
Well, if you read the dedication in the book, the dedication in the book is to my hometowns, my various hometowns, starting with New York City, because I was born there and my family was from New York City, moving to North Wales, moving to Philadelphia, moving to back to New York, then to Aspen, Colorado, then to Nashville. And each one of those places had a profound and significant impact on who I was as a person, who I became, who I was as a person, who I am as a person, and musically. So, the being in North Wales, growing up in a really kind of small town, healthy. You have to remember, North Wales of 1950s was not the North Wales of today.
No,
by any stretch of the imagination. I lived. Behind our house was a sheep farm and woods and fields, and I lived a really great, healthy country childhood. And then the proximity to Philadelphia and getting on the Reading Railroad and being able to be right downtown in Philadelphia in a short, you know, amount of time was an opportunity to experience what the city had to offer. And eventually I, you know, was gravitated and was, you know, drawn to Philadelphia for so many reasons. So it was just a great time to grow up. It was a great place to grow up. And it really colored everything I am, especially listening to local radio, having access here again to Philadelphia and it's all its musical influences.
So then brings us to your meeting of Daryl Hall and at an early time in your musical life and the influence that had and when you realized that that is a partnership that you want and something that you can make work. What I want.
Friends. We met in late 1967. So we were friends 68, 69, and 70. It wasn't until I came back from a trip to Europe that I took for 4 months in the summer of 1970 after I graduated that we actually began to formalize a musical partnership. And that was done not because we had ambitions or you know, kind of visions of greatness. It was done as an alternative to the fact that nothing was going on individually for us. Daryl was not satisfied or happy with the things he was doing. I wasn't doing much at all. And we looked at it as an opportunity to just casually make music together. And that's how we approached it. And it was never really, there was never a master plan or this grand, you know, grand vision of the future. It was, we just took it day by day.
In taking that day by day, but you found your sound, right? You found how you could work together. And I guess I'm interested in what you realized about what both of your strengths were and how you could market that into something that ultimately worked out so well.
Well, we didn't think about marketing anything. We, you know, interestingly enough, I mean, over the years, you know, I think we've been perceived as these pop, you know, these pop craftsmen with a unholy alliance to the gods of radio that could just whip out a number one record, you know, in our sleep. Nothing could be further from the truth. We really kind of took things as they came. I think what we both recognized was the strengths and weaknesses of our individual talents. Daryl came from a musical family. He was classically trained, but he was also a real street kid, a real street doo-wop harmony singer. And I was a folk musician, basically, folk early rock and roll kind of blues musician. And I taught him about traditional American music and roots music. He taught me a lot more sophistication from his, you know, piano playing and things like that. And we blended our talents, really, in the early days. And then from that, you know, you have to remember, we didn't really find a sound for almost 4 years. We made three completely unique and different sounding records. The Whole Oats album, our first album on Atlantic, was a singer-songwriter record, very organic and acoustic in style. The Abandoned Luncheonette was a blending of acoustic music and R&B. And the War Babies album that we did with Todd Rundgren was an experimental progressive rock album. I think taking the elements of those three albums together kind of coalesced on our fourth album, and then we had a hit with Sarah Smile, which kind of put us on a course to have, you know, more commercial success.
And when you look at it now, the relationship is such is that you can perform together when you want to, and then you can perform by yourself when you want to, right? That seems like it's the best of both worlds.
We have the best of both worlds. I couldn't be happier with the situation. I mean, I love playing the. It's like Daryl and I have created all these children in the songs of that we created together as Hall & Oates. And we go out and we play those songs. People love them. They've resonated. They seem to have stood the test of time. We have this amazing band, and we have a ball doing it. We love doing it. But at the same time, we can step away and indulge our creativity individually. And that's the way we've always wanted it to be. And we're so lucky that we're able to actually pull that off.
Talk a little bit about the one of the headlines to come out of the book is the financial situation that you come in as really in after the height where you start making a lot of money, but you also start spending a lot of money. And as I said, that's really one of the things that, that came out of the book that has been making headlines. And I'm curious as to what that was like to write about and sort of reflect on of being on the other side of that now.
Well, you know, when negative things happen to you, especially, you know, when business deals, first of all, you have to remember that this story that I'm writing about and in retelling this tale of financial, collapse is really an age old tale when it comes to the music business. This is not something new. I mean, take it back to the earliest days of rock and roll when the blues musicians came up the river to Chicago and wanted to make a record and guys signed them for a bottle of wine and here, throw this paper in front of you, sign your name here, kid. You'll be fine. And, you know, they gave away their rights for the rest of their life. This is the norm in the music business, not the odd situation. So I'm just retelling my personal version of it. Artistic people and creative people never want to be bogged down with business and the details of things like that. And when given the opportunity, there's always people who are willing to take advantage of that fact. And say, hey, kid, you know, just go on being a protracted adolescent for the rest of your life and go out and party and run around the world playing music and be a rock star and make great records and let us take care of all the other stuff. That's very appealing to the creative personality. And I fell into that trap. And there were people who, you know, did things that were not necessarily in our best interest. But at the same time, rather than be vindictive about it and accusatory, I took responsibility for it myself because I said to myself, you know, when I was writing the book and as I began to look back on the experience, I said, you know what? It was my own damn fault. I should have been more aware. I should have been more knowledgeable. I should have paid more attention, and I didn't. So I have no one else to blame but me. So there's no recrimination here. There's no really that because the fact that it happened, even though it seems so negative, and it was certainly impactful and very traumatic at the time. Now, in retrospect, looking back on it, it was the best thing that ever happened to me because it caused me to become a grown-up. It caused me to change my life. It caused me to really restructure everything I did in my life. And I came out a much better person and a very successful person because of that experience. Had I not had that experience, I don't know what would have happened to me.
Musically speaking, what are you proudest of?
My solo work. Everything I've done since 2000, the year 2000. In the heat of the day, down in Mobile, Alabama. Working on a railroad with a steel driving hammer. Got to get some money, buy some brand new shoes. Got to find somebody, take away this blues. Singing in the sun. Well, payday coming in, my work is all done.
And what is it about that that makes you so proud?
Well, because it's a purely personal, you know, personal expression, unfiltered, uncompromised, untainted by partnership. And partnership, by its very nature, is a compromise. Or else it doesn't work. And as you can see, the fact that Daryl and I are still together after all these years means that there's a lot of compromise involved by both parts. So in that regard, my solo work is pure, and that's why it's much more immediate because it's much more recent. I'm not to say I'm not proud of the work I did with Daryl. I'm very proud of it because it was a lifetime of work. But that lifetime was a lifetime of it's almost like my childhood lifetime, and now my childhood is over. And the work of my adulthood is really a different expression. And I'm you know, it's like I wake up every day and I can't wait to see what's going to happen. I've surrounded myself in Nashville with a musical community that is supportive and creative and inspiring. And it's just been a joy. I'm working on a new album for 2018 that's called Hurt, that where I'm taking it originally started as a tribute to Mississippi John Hurt, and now it's expanded into this kind of modern Americana take on traditional blues music. And it's really creative, and I've got these incredible players who are working on it with me. So just these, you know, it's really a goal. It feels like a golden sunset in a very long career.
We should note there's a great CD in the book as well.
Well, the CD in the book it's actually an EP. There's five songs.
Yeah.
It's really, I picked a few obscure, very personal songs that seem to exemplify the things I'm talking about in the book.
Well, the name of the memoir is Change of Seasons. John Oates, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us, and best of luck with the book and the future work as well.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the memoir is Change of Seasons by John Oates. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.